The next case is 99-2293, Patricia Linko, Executrix versus Indemnity Insurance Company, North America.
Chief Justice Moore, members of the Supreme Court, may I please call you? In 1996, this court decided Jury versus Johnson Coca-Cola, in which it decided the standards for determining whether or not uninsured motorist coverage is validly rejected under Ohio law. The present case presents an opportunity for this court to set forth a similar bright-line test for determining whether or not a valid offer
Let me stop you there. Ask you a threshold question, I guess. If you decide that Mr. Linko and his executrix of the state has standing or could raise the issue of the waiver of the uninsured motorist coverage, isn't the rest of the question that's presented to us factual? Or can be decided by either by corporation law or agency law. It seems to me we're being asked to decide issues that need to be determined by the facts.
I don't believe so, Chief Justice.
Was the authority of the person who signed, Mr. Conley, signed? What was his authority? We don't need Ohio. We don't need a state of Ohio law on that, do we, or do we?
I believe so, Your Honor, because the defendant in this case, or the insurance company in this case, is trying to bring in evidence that was created after the commencement of the policy period.
So we need a statement in law that says if you file affidavits after, but after the action is commenced, that's you can either do that or can't do that. That doesn't seem like an issue that we need to decide.
Clearly, Justice Moore, there is some direction needed on that issue. As you know, this is one of the most heavily litigated consumer issues of our day, and that is precisely because there's a lack of direction out there in the case law on what evidentiary standards apply. Certainly, the courts below would benefit from direction from this court indicating that they can only consider the four corners of the insurance agreement in deciding whether or not a rejection is validly made, rather than going to evidentiary submissions that are created after the fact.
But the four corners of insurance policy don't really decide issues of agency and like commission and all of those things. Those aren't interpretation of contract. Those are authority of contract. You can't tell us about contract itself. You can go back to the lawyer and see that fact.
That's exactly why we need law on this issue, Justice Stratton. What would you ask this court to hold is that failing to include the fact of authority expressly in the rejection form is failed to claim that there was a valid rejection on behalf of all the named insurers.
Should that be a policy decision by the legislature rather than just grafting the oil restriction that we have? So many restrictions that you've put on the uninsured motorist statute
already, many of which probably are removed by the legislature.
Why don't you go to the legislature
and
make that decision? They can decide that's
become
a policy decision.
As you know, this court has already decided that there is a requirement of an offer in writing and a rejection in writing, and the failure to contain all of the elements of the rejection in writing should be fatal to a claim. I'm not really asking this court to change the law, asking this court to clarify what evidentiary submissions can be considered in deciding whether or not the signatory had authority.
And you have plenty of agency law after this.
I respectfully disagree, because that's why we're in the jackpot in this case, because there is not sufficient direction out there as to whether or not standing agency law allows, for instance, the court Western District of New York to consider affidavits that are put together by the named insured and the insurer after the fact. The policyholder loses in that every time, because the policyholder has the incentive to bring a case, but the named insured has no incentive to bring to seek coverage. In fact, has disincentives to seek coverage.
The court complies, the agency law, have to look at the affidavit and say as a factual support in reality, or the affidavit, or the affidavit bogus. Look at the other facts. Are the affidavits valid or are they not valid? A trial court determined that, not are we going to pass some sort of blanket law that you can't put an affidavit together about facts that happened before the affidavit?
Well, again, Your Honor, and that's why there's direction needed from this court on this issue. The sufficiency of the rejection form as decided in the jury should be considered from the commencement of the policy period. If other courts are allowed to look at facts that are developed after the fact, when there are incentives for collusion between the insurer and the name, the insurer and the named insurer, the named insurer has incentives such as concerns about their premium rates going up, concerns about whether or not they're going to have to pay deductibles. When those issues enter into their consideration, they now have an incentive to come back after the fact and say, oh, all along we wanted to waive coverage. The protection afforded by the statute to consumers is completely promoted through a bright-line rule of law that says the trial courts can only consider facts that are in existence at the time of commencement of the policy period, and they have to look at the four corners of the insurance agreement. And there is no law in point in the UM context, and I think it's important that some law be made on that. Again, as set forth in Giori, these requirements will prevent needless litigation and also give the insurance companies the benefit of knowing for certain what they have to have in their rejection form prior to litigation. So, likewise, on the offer issue that's presented before this court, the petitioner requests that the court consider the terms of an offer to decide what would be a valid offer under Ohio law. Petitioner submits that an appropriate offer should, at a minimum, meet the standards of offer and acceptance under general contract law, which would include the definiteness in terms of the terms of the coverage and in terms of the cost of the coverage. Certainly, the jury case says that the offer must be in writing. Petitioner is saying, well, what must the offer contain? Certainly, in the UM context, it should at least meet the requirements of general contract law due to fiduciary duty, policy considerations underlying that statute. Petitioner submits that in terms of that offer should at a minimum contain a statement of premium costs and a statement of what coverage is and what the coverage amount is.
And would you be satisfied then if we advised the federal court that it should apply general contract law to that issue? I take it there's no new law for us to write there. If general contract law applies, would be sufficient for us to tell the court that's what you should apply? Or?
Well, again, Your Honor, since we have this case here, it seems in the spirit of Giori where a bright-line test was favored, it seems to make sense in this heavily litigated area of law that a bright-line test saying that premium cost, specifically a description of the coverage specifically, and the coverage limit specifically, would be a better statement of law rather than falling back on a generic follow general contract principles.
The trick might be then, if this court were to do that, would that be prospective only? In that, I suppose folks in past practice might not have understood. They might have been relying on general concepts that this really wasn't a fully integrated contract. Rather, it's merely rejecting coverage, or you know. So it might be such new ground that would it be fair to say and to make this as an answer to a certified question seems even another hurdle. But
Justice, I disagree. I would think that since it dovetails with existing contract principles, and since the law of this court, once it's established, applies to cases that are in existence, I don't think it has a prospective or an unfair prospective application any different than any other decision by
the court. The peerless case, in what we commonly call the peerless doctrine, says the law, this is not, new cases would be, that's the law always was that way. But we'd now say the law always was that, and it, you know, even though the statute says it only needs to be in writing, well, now we're going to say, yeah, but that meant, you know, and all the terms, all the things you're suggesting that might need to be in there we'd say if they weren't in there, even though the statute didn't say it, we're saying now, bright line, it always needed to have all the terms or, you know, the suggestions that you make.
Well, the flip side of that is the insurer is asking this court to say, well, we have a rejection form. That also is our offer form. Well, that would be just as interpreted by this court to decide, yes, that a rejection form is in effect an offer form. And again, it defines existing principles of contract law, which say that you have to have some definiteness.
I guess we'd end up first have to get to the threshold of whether this is this offer and accept it. You know, this particular endorsement arguably needs to be a separate, fully integrated, thought of and conceived as a separate, fully integrated contract as opposed to the policy being the contract. And here's an endorsement, take it or leave it kind of thing.
Well, I think with regard to the offer, that does not have to be part of the policy. That can be contained in a bid proposal or an approach sheet. But with regard to the rejection, that has to be part of the policy.
Mm-hmm.
So in looking at the offer, whether or not that's sufficient, obviously you have to go outside of the contract to decide whether or not the offer is sufficient. You look at the bid proposal form, or you can look at quote forms. But again, those forms should at least tell the consumer, before the consumer can decide, well, this is not a good benefit for my employees, they should at least know, well, what's it going to cost? And what does it provide my employees?
The form seems to anticipate that there has been some negotiating over the terms. I would guess in a commercial contract like this, I would guess there would be negotiating between the company and the insurance company. There are blank amounts here for liability and so forth. What you would have, I'm trying to see how you would have us require, and on the form, the Cigna form, would you have something attached to that which would show the premiums, show offers, that various offers, that for this amount of premium you get this, or how would that work?
Yes, Chief Justice, if you look at, and again, this court doesn't have the benefit of having all the evidentiary submissions before it, I don't believe, but if you look at the bid proposal in this case, it has great language in it. It says that we have an obligation to offer you uninsured motorist coverage under Ohio law. Then it says, and we will offer it to you in this amount, and it has TBD, to be determined, for the quote for the premium cost. So all I would ask is fill that in. Have the insurer say, here's what UM coverage is. Here's what it costs. In other words, quote the bid amount, quote the premium amount, and then state what the coverage limits would be. And I think they satisfy their duty under the statute if they meet those three basic requirements of a satisfactory offer.
Is it your interest in having that be a part of the law because it reflects the fact that the parties knew precisely what the agreement was, or what the purpose of that served?
This is a really interesting case, actually, because what happened in this case, you had a number of corporations that combined together under the rubric of a holding company, in fact, and these were very separate independent companies that were brought together. The company that my client worked for had issued him a memorandum saying, you have uninsured, underinsured motorist coverage under your policy. This is the work company. The other hand of this equation, San Clemente equation, then goes out and rejects uninsured, underinsured motorist coverage. So we've got facts that show that the risk manager for San Clemente Corporation never got permission from the Norton company to do so. So you've got an excellent example in this case of what can go wrong when the insurer fails to specifically talk to each insured or addresses an authorized representative of each insured, named insured, and gets their express written rejection of coverage before saying the coverage is
rejected. It seems to me that you may win that issue factually in the trial court if that's developed, but what you're really asking us to do here is to say, as a matter of law, the forms have to include this information.
There are two different approaches there. I think it would really help litigants in this state to have that statement of law. Here's what you have to have. Because I'll tell you, frankly, none of the rejection forms contain that information. The insurance companies are not providing that type of information. think it would be a great opportunity to provide that information in this case or to give that statement of law in this case.
Do you have any idea why the other side didn't file a brief?
I think they did, but it was late.
It's late, probably. Yeah.
Oh, well, it isn't in my folder, so I...
Yeah, it's probably late.
Okay.
So, in closing, this case presents an excellent opportunity for this court to set standards, legal standards, bright line legal standards in the state of Ohio for what constitutes a sufficient offer. And secondly, to establish, in order to protect consumers from after-the-fact collusion by named insureds and insurance companies, to protect the consumer by saying you can only consider the facts as contained in the insurance agreement and decide whether or not coverage was validly rejected.
When a policy of insurance is sold to a husband and wife, both named insured, you'd require that both of them, in writing, reject the coverage.
I think the spouse, one spouse can reject for the other spouse, but they have to write on the rejection form that coverage is being rejected by spouse one and spouse two. Spouse one is signed for himself and as an authorized representative for spouse two. I think that would be the statute of requirements.
So you have to go through all of that. You might as well have her sign or him sign.
That would be better.
Okay.
That would be better.
So you think that's a requirement, but you believe that one spouse can assign for the other if they're authorized. Why not between corporations?
Well, if they are authorized, I don't have a problem with that. But the problem is that when that authorization...
Here you say there was no authorization.
Well, not exactly, Justice Douglas. I'm saying that the authorization is not set forth in the four corners of the insurance agreement. Therefore, it violates the basic principles of contract interpretation.
Isn't there at least an authorization that if someone signs
right.
with a parent company,
it is.
That person has been purportedly signing, but the parent company is one that bought the policy. Is that what the Norton
suggests?
Or is the parent company?
I think Samuel Van Corporation is the parent company.
One of the briefs says the other way around.
I saw that.
Yeah,
okay. That's correct.
The form signed by someone, and you're correct, of course, there's no, he doesn't identify his position, but if it's signed by someone for the company that purchased the insurance for all of the subsidiaries, isn't there at least an implication that the person has the authority to do that, and then it's up to your client to, if we give the client standing, which I frankly think should seem to be a strong argument, courts have seemed to say that then that there's a challenge to the authority under the traditional kind of challenges that one makes to authority.
Yeah, and Chief Justice, I have to say that in your statement, you use the term implication. She already says that you cannot arrive or raise a rejection by implication. It has to be expressed, it has to be knowing, and it has to be implicated.
Well, but that's where...
You're going to develop authority by implication. Now are going contrary to the policy and the law of jury. And
it would be, it'd be contrary to the law of agency that apparent authority would work in every other sort of contract, but not this rejection form.
That's a great point, and the court should consider that there's two things going on in the UM context. You've got contractual considerations, you also have statutory considerations.
Mm-hmm.
The statutory consideration that's set forth in jury and the interpretation of statute is that we want a bright line test to try to stem the tide of litigation on these issues. A bright line test that protects consumers. We want all the information contained in writing in the agreement
so that
insurers and insurers, after the fact, can't put together arguments.
That's not in the statute, though. You said statutory authority.
Well, the jury is a judicial interpretation of the statute, so.
Okay.
Thank you. Quickly.
Thank you.
Appellee has not filed a brief, therefore, waives oral argument. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Thank you for your recess.